Not necessarily. Oh yeah, pause. I almost forgot to pause, Alyssa. See, I have very short-term memory. From Amanda. Hi. Hi. I have a long-standing daily practice. Great. Initially Theravadin, and now with Sogyal Rinpoche. He's a rock star. I love that guy. But would like to deepen my nighttime practice. Okay, good thing. Will the retreat in Spain? Okay, so that's part of the advertising. I'm doing several retreats, one in Spain, one in France, and maybe one in Ibiza, beautiful island in the Caribbean, maybe. Will the retreat in Spain just cover liminal states? I do yoga nidra and lucid dreaming, or go into dream yoga and sleep yoga too. Okay. It's going to cover liminal dreaming, yoga nidra, lucid dreaming, and dream yoga, not sleep yoga. Sleep yoga is pretty esoteric stuff. I don't do too many sleep yoga programs, but it will definitely do liminal dreaming, lucid dreaming, and dream yoga for sure. And like you said, depending on the group, the really cool thing about this group is this is the invitation came from a group of traders, not traitors, traders, out of London. So it's going to be geared slightly towards the financial community, business stuff. And originally, when they pitched it to me, I was like, okay, well, how can I really? Because he said, I want you to do something on dream yoga for these people. And I'm going, geez, okay. So I had a really fun time talking to Alex about all this. And so it's going to be really kind of practical, hands-on way to approach liminal dream principles with stress, business, that kind of demographic and population. And all the while doing the, the classic standard liminal lucid dreaming kind of thing. Back to her, I had an interesting experience with the deep breathing we did at Prana. Oh, so this is that Amanda. Oh, I'm sorry, Amanda. This is my British Amanda, who was at Prana with me. This question just came in, so I hadn't seen it before. Yes. Okay. So now I know who you are. I had an interesting experience with the deep breathing we did at Prana. Yeah, we did this really powerful kind of shamanic breathing thing. It was awesome. So hope to come on tonight to discuss this. Cool. Well, if you come on, I'm here to talk to you, Amanda. Nice to hear from you. Okay, from Tanya. When I focus my mental awareness on different parts of my body, I soon become aware of heightened sensations in that area. Yeah, totally. Absolutely. No surprise there. Question, do you know, are there physiological changes happening in the capillaries or increased blood flow? Yes, for sure. Or is it prana that moves? Both. It's both. And I get to sense that. Yeah, you're sensing both. Remember, the prana is more foundational, right? The subtle body, prana is associated with subtle body, the blood, the capillaries, and all that. That's gross body. So gross body is an epiphenomenal expression of subtle body like prana. So the prana is actually definitely working here, as is increased blood flow for sure. I'm very interested in knowing whether this phenomenon is physiologically measurable. For sure. Blood flow is prana, no. Not yet, anyway. I mean, yeah, there's some anecdotal stuff, but there's no definitive studies that I'm aware of the ability to measure subtle body processes yet. So prana is not measurable, but increased blood flow is for sure. I mean, with fMRIs, that's kind of what they do, right? Functional magnetic resonance imaging. If this is physiologically measurable, could focusing one's mental awareness to a specific body part be used to signal lucidity in the sleep laboratory? Sure, absolutely. But why do that? It's a lot easier to do what's already been done, Tanya. You could do that, but that's really subtle measurement stuff. You can do it with EMGs, EOGs. You can do it with what you say here. Perrin, Dr. Ed mentioned that Stephen LeBerge cleansed his wrist muscle, signaling repeatedly to signal lucidity. Could he have also focused his mental awareness on his wrist? Yes, he could, but how do you measure that? It's a lot harder. You don't want to have, fMRIs are really expensive. It's a lot easier to do EEG, EMGs, EOGs, and that sort of thing. So you don't have to go through what you're saying is true. You could do it that way, but this is a more subtle marker. And why spend the money? Why go through the subtlety when you can do it in easier, kind of more gross ways? Do you know what type of equipment would be needed to measure changes in the capillaries? Yeah. Basically, analogs to fMRIs. But again, I'm not like a full-blown clinical dream researcher. And even then, they have special people that come in and do these tests, irrespective of the scientists that actually implement them. So my reply to this is you can totally do that, but why? Why not use more classic EOGs, electroocular, EMGs, electrical myography? You can use the muscle thing, you can use the eyes thing. You don't have to do this stuff. Okay. But theoretically, yes, you could definitely do it, but why bother? Okay, from Wes, I want to do the visualizations, visual meditations you describe in your Dream Yoga book. I've been having a lot of trouble visualizing things, though. I have looked intently at an object like an apple, close my eyes and try to see the apple, but all I see is black. Is there a more basic step that I can start with? Well, one thing you might consider, Wes, is you may well be dealing with aphantasia, which is an inability to actually visualize, or a great difficulty in visualizing. So it's not as uncommon as you might think. In fact, the longer I'm in the business and the longer I tool around, the more I hear about it. So this to me sounds like classic aphantasia. Now, this doesn't mean you can't use the throat visualizations and whatnot, but then what you do is you transition from a visualization to a feelingization. Excuse me. By this, what I mean is, if you're working with a visualization at the throat, which is what I write about in the Dream Yoga book, if you can't visualize it, you can feel it. You can. You know, that's why when I depict it, you want it to feel the petals fluttering. You want to create a sense of dimensionality. You want to get other senses involved in terms of registering. So visualization, yes, it does use classically visualization as we know it, but it's really other senses are involved, other faculties are involved. But you may want to just be tested anyway, period. It's interesting. It sounds like it could be classic aphantasia. Look it up, check with your PCP, your primary care physician, maybe visit with a neurologist, and then see if in fact you're afflicted with that situation. Kind of sounds like it. But there are other ways to work with visualization. One is just the one I mentioned, just working with a kind of somatic feelingization approach. You can still do it that way for sure. It's not in any way a handicap. From Patrick, I brought The Power and Pain. Okay, that's my first book. I like the typo here, Patrick. I bought Power and the Pan. This book is not about pans, man. It's about pain. Sorry, I like to dance with my people. I brought The Power in the Pan, okay? Power in the Pain, and Preparing to Die last week. Thank you for doing that. That's really cool. Do you recommend that we pre-order the Reverse Meditation book? Hell yeah. That's my next book coming out, right? Talk about shameless self-promotion. Order the damn thing. Because if we get 10,000 people, I get on the New York Times bestseller list. Did you realize that you have to have at least 10,000 people to get on that? And if you get it on the first week, you get on the New York Times bestseller list. And I actually talked to a friend. I mean, check this out. I don't know if it's true, but I trust this person. She says she knows of a guy. You give him $100,000, he'll get you on the New York Times bestseller list, right? It sounds like the little scam I got ripped off on my, I got taken for a little ride on a website this week, a little humbling experience. Whether I know if the $100,000 on the New York Times bestseller, it's probably true, but I don't know. So do you recommend we pre-order it? Sure, Patrick, if it speaks to you, I would be honored if you ordered it. Thank you for the thought. Or wait till you buy it when it comes out in June. Whatever works best for you. The pre-ordering does help. Honestly, it really does. In fact, just this week, I had my marketing meeting and all that stuff. It's kind of amazing these days, you know, for writers. Those of you who are writers, you know, it's not like it used to be. If you don't have social media, if you don't have your own team, if you don't have it, whatever, these publishing houses don't do anything. Well, not quite. I shouldn't say that. That's not quite true. They don't do as much as they used to, but so much rests on the author these days. It's a lot of work. You said recently I had some health issues. Those health issues are all resolved. Thank you for asking. Any healing prayers and meditations? No, thank you. I appreciate that, but I'm okay in that department. I really appreciate the thought. All right. When I first did instructions on Qinglin. Okay. So the rest of it are just comments. Thank you, Patrick, for your very kind words about ordering my books. And if you want to look into the Reverse Meditation book, I would be honored if you would do that. That'd be cool. Thanks for asking. Okay, Michael, since retiring from a successful career last April, good for you on both fronts, retiring and being successful. I have been having almost nightly dreams about stressful work situations. No surprise. That's me, no surprise. These dreams are always a mashup of every job I've had over 40 years. I would like to learn how to have some control over my dreams, but I only recently joined nightclub. I have a spiritual practice that includes daily meditation and volunteer counseling of people with terminal illness. Oh, good for you. Wonderful for doing all that. Okay, Michael, so in terms of the controlling the dream thing, yeah, sure, there's a bunch of things you can do. Let's start with some daytime stuff. When you're really working to control, and we'll talk about this notion of control altogether, it's an interesting word in the contemplative traditions and also in the dream arena. When we talk about control, start with the daytime mind, because remember, the maxim I use is that thoughts are to waking consciousness as dreams are to dreaming consciousness. So basically our control or lack thereof over dreams is directly related to our control or lack thereof of the contents of our mind during the day. So one of the best things you can do to learn how to control your dreams, and again, what are dreams made of, right? Dreams are made of your mind. So in a real way, what you're saying here is I would like to learn how to have some control over my mind. That's really what you're asking. So if you want to learn how to control your mind, meditation, man, it's like the best. Meditation. And this is also where it gets really interesting, because during the day and night, you can control your mind in a number of different ways. But because meditation has a number of different applications to the way you relate to your mind. On one level, you can control your mind with space. I love this end of it. You just basically mix your mind with space, classic meditation, especially open awareness meditation during the day. And you control your mind by making it open, spacious, relaxed. And so therefore, it's a type of control intimated by what Suzuki Roshi said in his classic book, Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, where he said, if you want to control a herd of cattle, don't put them in a corral, give them a pasture. That's really beautiful. So if you want to control your mind, control it with space. In other words, control your relationship to your mind, right? That's the most important thing. Now, that does not mean that you're unable or it's not beneficial to work with controlling your dreams. I'll get back to that in just a second. But sometimes this whole idea of mind control, it can backfire on you, because on one level, and this is really, really important, especially in terms of things like free will and all this kind of gets really deep. On one level, you can't really control what arises in your mind. I mean, try, right? I mean, try, get back to me. Try to control what arises in your mind. Yes, temporarily you can muscle it down, but you can't really control the arising of the contents of your mind, at least indefinitely. And the contemplative traditions would say you shouldn't even try. I mean, it's like Milarepa sings in one of his songs, you know, the play of the mind cannot be stopped with hundreds with spears. That's not the point. The point is to control your relationship to the arising. That's the key here. And that control is brought about by this space, this ability to actually relate to your mind instead of from it. That's the control. So during the day, you want to control your mind during the day with this meditative approach. And it's a little bit like saying, okay, this is another analogy. It's a little like saying, okay, I want to control the weather. I want to control the clouds that float through the sky. Well, why do you want to do that? Let the clouds come and go. Let the weather come and go. Don't try to control it. Control your relationship to it. So with that said, then that proficiency will extend into the dream arena. And then you can engage in kind of lucid dreaming, dream yoga in particular, where yes, at the first, you know, stages 2 through 7, there is some kind of control in the tantric sense where you work with transforming the contents of your mind. So control there does come into play. And if you're interested in that, stages 2 through 7 of dream yoga are all about that. Stages 8 and 9 are more about what I talked about earlier. But even then, in what's called a pellucid dream, which is a witnessing awareness dream, you're lucid in the dream. You're fully aware of the fact that you're dreaming, but you simply elect to just watch. That's a type of control. You're now relating to the dream content instead of from it. So basically, Michael, you want to do this? Meditate. Work with Shamatha Vipassana meditations. Work with open awareness. That proficiency will naturally extend to the dream arena. That will help you alter your relationship to your mind as it expresses itself during the day or at night. And then really, the most important thing is control your mind with space, not this kind of muscular control, right? Don't do that. Way too tight. And then control your mind in the sense of relationship. That's the key. Okay, from KTE. In his commentary to the six yogas of Naropa, Tsongkhapa says, okay, so Naropa is one of the great siddhas, principally in the Kagyu tradition. Tsongkhapa was the founder of the Gelugpa tradition. And one of the first things I say right off the bat, Katie, is if you're on the line, who translated this? Because a lot of times, and you'll see, well, I'll say more about this, a lot of the issues come about by the way translators work with these texts. So if you're here and can tell me who translated this, it will help me. So apparently Tsongkhapa says, amazing Gelugpa master, quote, this practice, I mean, I suppose this practice is dream yoga, but you don't tell me. This practice involves controlling the contents of beyond the world dreams. I suspect that's dream yoga. If it's not, let me know. This involves consciously projecting oneself in the dream state to the various Buddha fields, such as Sukhavati, Tushita, Akanishta, and so forth. And so this is why I wonder, this is me talking, who translated this? Because Tushita and Akanishta are not Buddha fields, they're God realms. So that's one little difference in translation or boo-boo. It's not a Buddha field. Sukhavati is a Buddha field. Tushita is a heaven, God realm. Akanishta is a God realm. They're not the same thing. God realms are just the best of samsara. You're still in samsara. Buddha feels like Sukhavati or trans-samsaric. You're beyond samsara. So right there, there's already like, not quite right. At least the way I understand it. And then still back to Tsongkhapa. And while they're meeting the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, yes, you're going to do that in Sukhavati. You will not necessarily do that in Tushita and Akanishta. You're going to meet other gods there. You're not going to meet the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. Back to you, venerating them, listening to their teachings and so forth. Yes, beautiful. That's what you do in the pure lands. In fact, the pure realms experienced by those initial stages, pretty advanced initial stage, are merely reflections of the real thing. It is not that easy to experience the actual pure dimensions. Okay. End quote. What?
Huh? She said Glenn H. Mullen.
Yeah, I figured. I thought it was Glenn. Yeah, I thought so. Yeah, I know this text. I have it in my library back here. I thought it was Glenn. He's great, by the way. But I don't know the Tibetan, and I don't know how we translated it. So that, again, it's amazing. This translation thing is a big deal. And this is why I have so much respect for the really heavy-duty translators. And I'm not saying Glenn is not that. He's a really great guy. But I have a lot of very, very close friends that are really lifetime dedicated translators. And the amount of work, study, practice involved being authentic translation is huge. So this whole idea of lost in translation is a real deal. So again, I don't know the Tibetan here, but I can tell you Tushita, Akanishta, Sukhavati, they're not the same. They're not pure realms. Sukhavati is, these others aren't. Okay, back to you. What might be the difference between mere reflections and the real thing? Okay. And differences between the reaching them. Between the ways of reaching them. Okay. Well, again, it's a little bit difficult to say. I would like to know what the word mere reflection and real thing is. It nitartha, nayartha? I mean, naden, trangden, provisional, definitive? I don't know which terms they're translating. And that makes a difference. So the real thing, the difference between, let me just tell you what comes to mind, Katie. The difference between mere reflections and the real thing to me suggests the difference between appearance and reality, right? And so again, this is something that's been talked about for thousands of years, going all the way back to Plato and the cave, the allegory of the cave, going back to Parmenides. David Bohm, contemporary physicist, talks about it as the difference between the implicate and the explicate order. Kant talked about it as the difference between noumenon, phenomena. I mean, there are literally dozens and dozens and dozens of thinkers, philosophers, mystics for thousands of years who have talked about this difference between relative and absolute reality. So that's the way I read this. Mere reflections, relative reality, the real thing, absolute reality. Any differences between ways of reaching them? Well, you've already reached mere reflections. You're living in the world of appearance. You've already reached that, right? The real thing, yeah, that's the spiritual path. Cutting through mere reflections, mere appearance, to the underlying nature, reality, below, beneath, behind it. In many ways, that's what spiritual suggests in contradistinction to the physical or the mystical. It's basically intimating cutting through mere appearance into reality behind it. So that's probably the best I can do with this, dear, unless you want to come on and say some more about it after I finish these questions. But this is where I run with it. It's somewhat a translation issue, difference between mere reflections and the real thing. That's the difference between relative and absolute truth. We live in the world of relative truth. You've reached that. Don't worry about reaching it. That's where you live. That's where we all live, mere reflections. The real thing, discovering that, literally discovering, uncovering, that's the psycho, spiritual, mystical path. Going from mere appearance to reality. Another way, a really more sophisticated way to do this, the absolute relative truth thing is very powerful, but the Yogacara, you know how much I love that tradition. This is where the three natures come in. You have Paratantra, you have Paranishmana, the absolute nature, perfectly pure nature, Paratantra, the dependent nature, and Parikalpata, the imaginary nature. So if you really want to centrifuge out this, study the three natures in the Yogacara. Okay. From Carrie. Hi, Andrew. Do you think that learning astral projection can help a person prepare for death? Absolutely. Yes. And also, let me just finish this and then I'll say something and put on both my somewhat skeptical scientific hat and then my more believer's hat, because I think you have to tread a careful line here, Carrie. Back to you. It seems that practicing intentionally letting go of one's body while astral projecting could help a person release attachment to their body during the dying process. For sure. Absolutely. And if you can't do that, take psychedelics. I'm not kidding. Honestly. Stan Groff worked with this. He's the man here. MD, PhD. He's been working with this for 60 years. Read his book, The Ultimate Journey. He's led... at this point, thousands and thousands and thousands of people remove all their fear of death by working with psychedelic agents. In particular, his area of expertise is LSD. And so I would honestly, if you don't want to do meditation, which is by far the best thing to do, I mean, the meditation journey is all about this. Psychedelics are a quick, easy way to do it. The issue there is stability, but it's totally viable. Here's the thing about the astral projection deal. For sure, if you can practice authentic out-of-body experiences, and again, this is, you know, stage 7 in dream yoga, my stage 7. This is a definitely a legitimate part of the wisdom traditions, for sure. And fortunately, unfortunately, it's also part of the new age stuff. And so again, with all due respect to the wonderful people, Monroe Institute, and people who really work with this, and I know a lot of people who do, I would be a little careful here. So I'm just going to put on a little bit of my skeptical scientific hat, because even though I do believe completely, and I've had some experiences with this, in this whole out-of-body astral projection thing, my skeptical hat is there's not been one that I'm aware of. And if there's somebody out there who can correct me, I will be humbled and corrected. You know, there's no definitive scientific study. And yes, do we have to bring everything down to science? No, we don't. But when people make these claims, and here's the deal, extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. And so the extraordinary claims are, okay, I can do this astral projection, I can go across the world or whatever. Great, fine. Well, if you can do that, you should be able to be tested. You should be able to be put into a lab. And I know some of the stuff they've done this, the work of remote viewing again, these books are all on my shelf back here. I've read a ton of these things. There should be really a way to systematically, rigorously study the authenticity of astral projection. And to the best of my knowledge, and if somebody out there knows better, please correct me, send me to these studies. That hasn't been done. So usually what happens, and again, Evan Thompson writes about this beautifully in his rigorous book, Waking Dreaming Being, Self-Unconsciousness and Neuroscience, Meditation, and Philosophy. He has a really great chapter on out-of-body experiences with a ton of studies, a ton of research. He's a very smart guy. And I really agree with his provisional conclusion, which is that most out-of-body experiences, astral projections, are altered embodiments. They're not actually not out of your body. It's altered embodiment. And they can do this with haptics. They can do this with VR. They're doing some really clever things with VR. They can bring about a sense of out-of-body experiences. It's just altered embodiment. And so Yeah, if you're into that kind of stuff and it helps you dislodge your exclusive identification with form, do it, go for it, fantastic. I just get a little slightly skeptical around some of the claims of people who teach this, say they do it all the time. Usually when I ask them a number of questions, I can suss out pretty quickly that what they're talking about is an out-of-body experience is basically a hyper-lucid dream. And there's ways to test this, by the way. This can be tested. The other gal who writes about this beautifully is, what's her name? Blackburn. Karen, is that her name? Used to be a parapsychologist, now a psychologist out of Britain, really sharp gal. She writes about this really beautifully in her book with Stephen LaBerge, edited with Jane Gockenbach and Steve LaBerge, called something like Sleeping Brain, Waking Mind or something like that. That one may be out of print. But after reading both of those contributions by Karen and Evan, I don't know, these are really clever people, really smart people using really powerful logic. It just made a lot of sense. So I don't mean to bust your bubble. If the stuff works for you, go for it. Who am I to say that it doesn't work? I've just heard from talking to a bunch of people who do this, they're not having astral projections. They're having hyperlucid dreams. But either way, even with a hyperlucid dream, the point here, as I read it, Carrie, is that anything that can dislodge exclusive identification with form, body, psychedelics, whatever, do it. The rest of it is a sidebar commentary. And that's just me. That's just my silly opinion. Okay, William, boy, lots of questions. These are awesome. Almost done. I don't have frequent lucid dreams, but I recently had one. I remember to try to walk through walls, which I did. That's very cool. That's like stage two, dream yoga. Look at my hands. I remember something recommended that, and I did mountains from my Vajrayana practice. I'm not sure what that means. But one time I was floating in the clear sky, and I thought at that point, am I dead? I've had experiences like that as well. My question is, how do I know? Would the Bardo experience be like this? How do you distinguish? Great question, William. Yes, the Bardo experience is definitely like this. And that's why, guess what? Dream yoga is a concordant experience of the Bardo of becoming. So if you want to get a sense of what it's going to be like to be in the Bardo, really work with lucidity in the dream. Oh, let me share this dream. Oh, this is a good one. This just came to my mind. I was in my 3-year retreat when I had this dream. So I was having tons of these things. And I think I shared this somewhere along the line. I had a particularly bizarre dream. I mean, it was just weird. I've had tons and tons of lucid dreams, but this one was just different. And I just couldn't tell. I was like, this dream is weird. So I was lucid and there were all these other beings and entities walking around me. And it was kind of an airport thing. It had airport kind of vibe. And then finally, I had enough sense in the lucid dream to actually ask one of the people, whatever agents coming by in the dream. And by the way, I talk about this in my conversation with Ryan Hurd this week, you know, the agentic nature of characters in the dream. Are they really just your mind or are they coming up from outside? I talk about that with him. And so this person, this whatever, I can't remember, male, female, comes by. And I just stopped them and asked them, like, excuse me, I go, what is this? Where am I? And basically without stopping a step, this person said to me, you're in the Bardos. And I was like, oh, wow, cool, right? This is cool. Was I in the Bardo? I don't know. So this is a really great question, William. It's actually not that easy to tell when you're actually in that space. There are some texts that talk about it. Jamgon Kongtrul Lodro Tai's Treasury of Knowledge. There's some volumes that talk about the classic death signs and dream signs. And when I was reading these, and those again they're back. If you gave me 5 minutes, I could pull them. They're on the bookshelf right here. When I pulled that literature out and I read it, and Lodro Tai gives his 10 classic death sign experiences, I went through that and I said, man, these are dream signs. These are exactly the same phenomena that can take place in a dream. And then I said to myself, just like you're saying, how can you tell the difference between death and a dream? Well, one is the level of clarity. And again, I don't remember my Bardo experience all that well. But when you're in a dream, it's going to be a concordant experience of the Bardo becoming. It's concordant. It's a similitude. It's not the Bardo becoming. You're not dead yet. All the prana is still in your body. You haven't been translocated in that way. And so therefore it's concordant. It's not exactly the same. So what I understand from the literature is it's going to be less clear, less articulate, more foggy, more disjointed in the nighttime dream than at the dream at the end of time. And again, that's the way they talk about the bardos, the dream at the end of time. So allegedly in the bardo after death, it's going to be like a dream, but I wouldn't say more real. I would just say more clear. And also one of the characteristics of being in the bardo becoming is you're going to pop. One of the reasons it gets, again, I don't remember, but this is what the literature says. You're going to pop from being in your bardo dream mindscape thing. You're going to pop back into this dimension. So that's one way to tell. And this is the classic thing. First, especially 3 weeks after you're dead. First of all, you're not going to know you're dead. It's going to be very much like a non-lucid dream. But one of the things they say that tends to happen very powerfully is people will come back. They come back to their haunts, their favorite places. They come back to their people. They come back, you know, to loved ones. There's all this stuff for the first 3 weeks where they're coming back to this dimension, to this planet, and they're hanging around. If they don't let go and continue to hang around, they become literally a ghost, what's called a manomaya, made of mind, a gandharva. And they just get stuck in this bardo. But eventually what happens is they will start to eventually lose level of connectivity to this. They'll start you on the 3 week mark. They'll start to transition into their next, whatever incarnation will be. But that's what makes the bardo so disjointed, right? There's your inner dreamscape, and then you come back, flip back, and you're here. There's also no day or night as we know it. There's just this mind haze, just like in a dream. There's no sun and moon, just like in a dream. So this is a really great question. And to the best of my knowledge, these are some of the characteristics that will help you distinguish them. But here's the most important thing is that if you become really familiar with the dreamscape, which is what you can do now, and you start to understand, wow, this is okay. I'm in a dream. This is the topography. This is the kind of mindscape. This is what a dream is really like. Then you'll actually have that increased reference point when you actually do get into the bardo. And the most important thing is the lucidity. You know, whether it's in the bardo, whether it's in the dream at night, or whether it's now in this dream, this is the third type of dream. This is a dream. The most important thing is lucidity / awareness. But there's definitely a very profound relationship between the nocturnal dream and the dream at the end of time. So I hope that helps. Good question. Okay, from Gry, Gary, but without the A. I like that. Actually, let me get these other two first, and then I'm going to get to yours, because yours is a little bit longer. Okay, from Raiden, what were your first few thoughts directly after waking from your first lucid dream? Oh, dude, I can just take a guess, but that's been like, wow, decades and decades ago. Probably something like, wow, that was freaking awesome. I can't remember. Let's just say it was that, okay? Wow, that was freaking awesome. That's what I said. I don't remember, man. But probably something like that. And even to this day, I wake up from these dreams. I had one, in fact, when I did this talisman thing, where you'll hear with Ryan Hurd, every time I do the talisman thing under my pillow, I have one. And so I wake up, even doing this for decades, I wake up from these dreams and it was like, wow, that was freaking awesome. So I still say that, right? Decades later. That's why I love this stuff. Okay, from Diane, can two or more people share a lucid dream together? Depends on who you ask. You talk to Stephen LaBerge and other scientists, and I love Stephen. He'd say no. He would say, and others would say, more scientifically type people would say no. What people think of as shared dreams, what he says are usually shared themes. I think there's some credibility to that. However, I have talked to a ton. This is one of the really cool things about traveling around and actually hanging with people like you, either here or in person. I have talked to a ton of people over a long period of time, people I really trust. That wouldn't have no reason to lie to me. They would say absolutely positively, we set this agreement up in advance. We would meet here. We had this dream. We wake up the next morning, we write it down, we get on the phone, we talk about it, and we go, yes, that was me. I was there. So I think so, yes. And let me just share one other thing around this. And I shared this story with Ryan Hurd. This is a pretty cool story. So a friend of mine somewhat recently, who I hadn't heard from in a while, pinged me. This is cool. Pinged me to share the following story. This is connected to what you're saying. Where she was hanging out with Trungpa Rinpoche, who's, you know, amazing siddha, and like having some evening thing. And she turned to him and said, you know, I had a really sweet dream about you the other night. And Rinpoche turned to her, you know, very directly and said, that was me. And she kind of said, yeah, that's sweet, nice, yeah, cool. And then he turned more directly, more firmly and said, no, that was me. And she said the same thing. Oh, yeah, Rinpoche, thanks. That's a really nice, sweet thought. No, third time he turns around, almost semi-raffle, and looked her straight in the eye and said, no, please understand, that was me. And so for some reason, then at that point, she got it. And for some reason, that really landed with me, because I've had many, many dreams with him and also with other really amazing minds, masters. And it's always been, I've always felt when I've had these dreams that, yeah, for sure, that was the Karmapa, that was whatever, Padmasambhava, that was some Rinpoche or whatever. I've always felt that, man, that really, really did seem like that was them. But, you know, I also talked about this with Ryan. I embody two different personas. You know, at night, I'm a little bit more liminal, more nocturnal, more free-flowing. You could even say more open-minded. I come on during the day, I get a little bit more nerdy. In fact, after this call, I'm going to have a big, long conversation with a bunch of scientists and academics to help study, design some studies. So I dance between these two worlds. And during the day, I tend to be more skeptical. I tend to put on my scientific hat, and I tend to go, really? I'm not so sure. But when I heard the story from her, it was like it was delivered with such clarity that I realized, oh my gosh, all those dreams, I mean, they really are these mind agencies entering my mindscape. For sure, 100%. Can you prove it? No, you can't prove it. You can't prove it scientifically, but not all proof has to be brought about through that scientific way. So that connects to this. Can two or more people share a lucid dream? Well, I had a dream. It was lucid. Trungpa Rinpoche was in there. Right? He's dead, so I couldn't ask him. But then for sure, we were sharing the same mind in that instant. So I would say, excuse me, yes, for sure, you can. Okay, so last one, and then we'll open it up. This is a really nice, big, deep one. How come we perceive the world outside of ourselves as solid? Okay, I'm going to take this apart because it's a little bit long and there's so much here. The first thing I'm going to do, Gry, I guess, Gary without an A, I guess, is Gry, right? First thing I might recommend, again, shameless self-promotion. This is entirely why I wrote my book, Dreams of Light. The whole book is on your questions. So how come we perceive the world outside ourselves as solid? Well, there's a ton of reasons. This is where integral approaches are necessary. But the principal reason we perceive the world as solid is because it's a psychological developmental issue born of fear. And basically what we do here, again, this is such a big topic. We perceive the world outside as solid as a mistake. We take the qualities of the way we relate to ourselves. You know, we don't see things the way they are. We see things the way we are. And because we see ourselves as relatively solid, even though when we take a really close look, we crumble under analysis. We take these qualities and like King Midas, we project them out into the world, freeze the world in our image. So we perceive the world outside ourselves as solid because we project those qualities outside onto the external world. The world is not solid. It's a dream. It's made of mind. It's flowing. We're the ones that freeze it. We do it principally out of fear for developmental reasons. We do it principally as a form of or kind of arrested development. So that's, again, that alone in itself is a book. Okay, and we perceive that people perceive the same shape or forms, for instance, moving around in the neighborhood. Well, they're not perceiving the same thing. Yes, within limits. And this is, you have to read this book. I just finished it. I had a book discussion group with my science friends. If you haven't read this book yet, you have to read this book. It's extremely well written, almost TMI, but it's a tour de force bestseller. An Immense World by Ed Yong. If you haven't read this book, you have to read it. It's an amazing book of years of amazing research, where he puts together in 13, 14 chapters, the amazing different ways that our animal brothers and sisters perceive reality. It is just beautiful. It's really, really cool book. I highly recommend it. He didn't go far enough, in my humble opinion. The very end of the book, he brings in some nice ecological stuff, but he doesn't really take it into this philosophical, spiritual thing, which is a shortcoming. But irrespective of that, it's a beautiful book. So we think that we see the world the same way. And yes, within certain parameters, we do. But do we really? I mean, this is, again, where developmental structures come into play. This is where culture wars come into play. I mean, are we really seeing the same thing? No, we're not. We do for convenience because we share collective karma and sense faculties and that sort of thing. So in a gross way, yes, that's why science provisionally works. We share a commonality. We share a common dream. This is a little bit connected. You know, can people have lucid dreams together? Well, we're having one right now. We're sharing this lucid dream together right now. It's called samsara. So on one level, we're sharing a lucid dream right now, even though for most of us, it's non-lucid. Are the objects in our daydream created in every instant? Yes, they are. Physics will tell you this, right? This is what quantum mechanics is. Out of the zero-point energy field, moment-to-moment, quantum field theory, phenomena arise as a moment of patterned excitation in the dream in that quantum field. Moment-to-moment, at lightning speeds, is created, arises, abides, and ceases. Right? Trillions of times happens, yes. Or are they solid dream images? Nothing is solid, man. Nothing. Nothing is solid. They're dream images, yes, in the sense that they're manifestations of mind, right? But they're not solipsistic. That's what this is a big question, man. They're not solipsistic dream images, but they're manifestations of mind. In that sense, they're dreams. They're not constant. Nothing's constant. They're not constant in any way. There's the illusion of constancy brought about by flicker fusion, brought about by all these phenomena. And again, my friend, you mentioned some of this in Dreams of Light. So you have looked at this. Cool. I'm asking because I'm moving about in the world now. Yes. Trying to look at everything like a dream. Good for you. That's loose reform practice. As one of the exercises from your book, Dreams of Light. So you are reading that book. Thank you. You're right that there is indeed something out there. Yes, there is something out there. Mind at large, right? That's the noumena. Frozen light, luminosity, emptiness. It's not you that's out there. It's something out there. Something is out there. It's not a thing. It's not physical. The way you append a label to it depends on who you talk to. I like Bernardo's riffing. It's mind at large. There is indeed something out there, quote unquote, but that we look at it the wrong way. Well, I wouldn't say the wrong way. We look at it in the way that we're predisposed culturally, phenomenologically, biologically, socially. That's the integral approach. That's not wrong. That's just our Umwelt. That's the main topic, one of the main terms in this Immense World book is Umwelt. There's a German term for how we live in this perceptual bubble. You can't say that it's wrong. It's wrong. It's fake news in relation to real news. Yes, that's connected to the other question. It's not wrong in the sense that this is our relative truth. This is our Umwelt. This is the way we enact our reality. It's not wrong. It's just limited. How should we look at what appears solid to us, all of us, at a given place? Well, again, this is what the whole book is about, right? Realize that appearance is not in harmony with reality. We should look at it with open eyes, open mind, open heart, open aperture of awareness. Don't get stuck in sensory limitations and seduction, which is really hard to do. And basically, the best message I can share with you is just keep your mind, heart, spirit open, 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 open. The more you open the aperture of all of those things, the more you'll see truly, cleanly. The more, I wouldn't say wrong, but more of these limited, developmental, phenomenological, all these ways that co-conspire to keep us in our perceptual umwelts, the more of those will start to be seen through. This is what creates growth and development, increased perspectives. This is evolution, is increase in heightened perspective. So this is a great deep question. Again, it's a little tricky when I get these really beautiful big questions and I have to speed off bullet point answers. It's not easy. So that's the best I can do. Hope it works. Took a mere 50 minutes. But anyway, yeah, let's get some live questions here and I'll shut these down. And fire away, Myra. So nice to see you.
Good to see you too. I was wondering even to how to ask these questions because I've been meditating and contemplated in the, this time would be the Moonbeams of Mahamudra.
Oh, that's a book.
And so today when I was reading, I just was thinking about the part of the unborn. But all this sudden, I realized that maybe, and I just don't want you to agree with me, but just to challenge me, the moment of lucidity before we go into the story or to try to change it or to fly, that flash of lucidity, not only in the dream, but in life. And I thought about the moment in the bardo, once you die, that moment that you have a flash where if you recognize the moment, you can go into, transcend into dharmata. You don't have to go in through the other doors or the other lights. It seems to me that there are similar moments. I said not to agree with me.
I was going to say, you want me to say no? I can't. When it's true, I have to say, yeah, that's spot on. That's 100% out. What would you like me to disagree with?
not disagree, but so all the rest of the story is just a de-reification game with different tools or different meditation, different visions, controlling. But we are just looking for that flash to make it stable, to make it the only, so not even make it stable. So right. We had that kind of perception, I guess.
Yes, exactly. I was just going to, that's one thing I was going to challenge a little bit because what are you making stable? Yeah, I mean, yes, if I'm hearing you properly, yes. You know, Rinpoche talked about it, Trungpa Rinpoche talked about it as first thought, best thought, which is a play on Ginsberg's notion, not even first thought. It's basically first glimpse, first taste, right? This is actually quite beautiful. You know, yogic direct valid cognition. When you at the first moment of perception, and this is what happens when you start to slow down, you start to see this. At the very first instant of perception, it's actually a non-dual, like you said, this is a complete non-dual spiritual Dharmakaya experience. That's it. It's perfectly pure. That's it. But then what happens is like a thunderclap. I love this analogy. It's like a thunderclap. So yeah, this amazing lightning flash that's truth, it's brilliant, it's bright. And then almost immediately until you go through the purification processes, what happens? The thunderclap comes back together at blistering lightning speeds. And then everything comes to bear, basically what? Using my languaging these days through contraction. So at a moment of openness, contact with reality, that's the flash. You're in contact with what's true. But for ego, it's too much. It's too bright. The umwelt is too open. And this is what Bernardo talks about beautifully. And this is great. This is the work of Carl Friston. He's mathematically shown this. And I don't speak that level of mathematics. But basically, if you were to see the world the way it really is, you would dissolve into an entropic soup. You would literally just vaporize. I didn't count it, but when I was talking to Bernardo, did I say this with Bernardo? I can't remember. I think that's what actually happens when you enter the bardo of Dharmata. You do turn into entropic soup. You do dissolve into the vast infinite display of reality. But then what happens is, unless you're so open that you can actually contain that brilliant light or whatever, then what do? You contract out of fear. And the minute you contract, the whole crap show starts. That crap show starts not only at the end of life, iteratively, it happens right now. So we have that flash of contact right now. That's openness, but usually happens so fast, right? We don't even see how fast it happens. We contract, we reference everything back to self. And you know that happens because the storylines start. That's when you know. That's when you know what's happening. You've left, you've had an out-of-body experience. You've left your body, so to speak. You start commenting on it. That's how you know you've left reality. And so what you're saying is really beautiful. Not only applies to the bardo at the end of life, it applies to the bardo as it happens right now. Slow down, open your eyes, open your heart, and you will realize that you're pulsating. It's in the Hindu tradition, this is the spanda, the tradition of the doctrine of vibration. that fundamentally we make contact with reality, it's too much, it's too open, whatever, we contract. And then the minute you contract, you've left samsara, you left nirvana, now you're in samsara. It's a construct, see? So yeah, basically everything you're saying, I completely agree with. I mean, spot on. Nice to hear, I love you. It. Always nice to hear from you.
Thank you.
Okay, hey, Katie.
Hey, Andrew.
Fire away.
Okay, so in our most recent dream circle, Chelsea and I were talking about false awakenings and our experience with them.
Yeah, cool.
And one of the things that we noticed is how vivid from a sensation perspective, like especially touch, but sensationally all around, we noticed that false awakenings are super vivid for both of us. And nice. It made us feel curious about whether false awakenings are, like, why that is. Are they on a different frequency than other dream experiences in the brain? Or is it just the fact that we believe that we're awake?
Yeah, that's it right there. That's it right there.
Dang it.
Let me just say something about that before you go further. I can't speak about the whole brain thing here.
Okay.
But in terms of, because I don't have one, but in terms of what you're saying, that's just it. The reason it feels clearer, and this is actually what characterizes the awakening. You don't know what's false yet, but you're clicking from something that seems a little bit less true, less dreamlike, into an experience that somehow that stance like helps you look back upon what you previously were involved in and say that was a dream. Well, in order for you to even say that, you have to be in a perspective or a stance that's clearer or more stable than where you just were, see? And so therefore that very flip in itself creates that sense of what you just talked about. That's completely characteristic of what a false awakening is. But here's the fundamental kicker. We all wake up at the end of a night like that into this and we go, oh, thank God I'm awake, right? No. Yeah. If you wake up and you think this is solid, lasting, independent, I think like Michael or Williams question, that's a false awakening. So we think we're awake right now, but if you see this world is dualistic, it's a false awakening. And that's the way we take the phenomenology of false awakenings in the nocturnal arena and extrapolate those insights into this arena. But I cut you off, but that's just what comes to mind around that.
Yeah, no, that's great. And I think a slight nuance that I'm curious about is even when I become lucid in the false awakening, it's still like super vivid. So even once I realize, oh, this is a dream, that vividness stays.
Yeah. Yeah. I would have to say in my experience, that's absolutely the case as well. Right. And so how many of these have you had? Have you one, two, three? Do you remember how many false awakenings you've had?
In a row?
Yeah.
The most I've ever had in a row was I was in my early 20s. I had 7 in a row.
Wow. That's Guinness.
And it was scary. It was before I was like really studying dream work. I was having a lot of lucid dreams, but I wasn't studying it and it freaked me out.
Yeah.
Because I felt like I was being pulled and sucked back in. And Chelsea is actually having that experience more now. Where she's having repetitive false awakenings. I don't have them that often now anymore, but I had one recently. Brought up the conversation topic.
Yeah. Do people know what false awakenings are? You probably do mine now. False awakening is when you're having a dream and you wake up from the dream. At least you think you have. You know, you're dreaming, you wake up from the dream and you go, oh, wow, that was a great dream. Wow, right. And then all of a sudden something goes, holy crap, I'm still dreaming. You've clicked away from one dream and into another. They're also called recursive dreams, like those nested dreams. And so then what happens, and I've had like 3 or 4, then you click in, oh, at least I'm awake now, and whatever, like, oh, holy shit, I'm still dreaming. Click, you go into another one, right? And so this is also very similar to what Trungpa Rinpoche once said beautifully, you know, the bad news is, you've heard this, the bad news is you're falling through space without a parachute. The good news is there is no ground. This is an intimation of that. There is no ground. So you think you're awake right now, same reason I mentioned with the question earlier. You think you're awake. You think this is real. This is just another dream. This is a false awakening. If you think you're awake right now and you see me separate from you, you're still sleeping. And so that's what you do, is you take these principles, you extrapolate them back here, and you go, okay, what are the dream signs? And then, you know, this is one way to separate from the earlier question about whether you're dreaming or in the bardo, one way is if you take this world to be solid, lasting, and independent, exactly the dream signs on the world of lucid dreaming that would allow you to realize that you are awake in relationship to that. What separates lucid dreaming from dream yoga is that then becomes the very dream set of dream signs that show you're still asleep in the world of dream yoga. You see the difference? And so again, you think you're awake now, but if you see me different from you, you see this world solid, lasting, and independent. You're still asleep. This is a false awakening. And it's the Buddhas, the ultimate lucid dreamers, that wake up to that. And how do they do that? In exactly the same way. They retreat, in a certain sense, to a dimension of mind and reality that is more real than this. That's what characterizes the perspective to even append the label that you were in a dream. See? So the only reason we don't know we're in a dream now is because we don't have stability in a level of mind from which we can say with complete authenticity, this is a dream. We simply haven't accessed and stabilized that clear light mind. See? And so once you understand that, then it's like, whoa, this is where dream yoga really separates itself from lucid dreaming. And this is where you can challenge ontologically the supremacy, the ontological supremacy of this so-called materialistic world. This world is not materialistic. This world is not made out of matter. It's not physical. This world is made of mind. Hard stop. So anyway, that's where I want to run with that. Good stuff.
Yeah, yeah. And I would just inquire with your study group, how might you study false awakenings? Not for you to answer right now, but just...
Oh, you mean like in a lab?
Yeah.
Well, first of all, they're hard to... You know, the biggest problem with these studies is replicability. That's the issue.
Yeah.
Study designs around these things are really tricky. I mean, you got to have someone who's really good at this crap, who can get into a lab where it's really expensive, they have all these scientists and all this crap hooked up to you, and say, okay, tonight I'm going to have a recursive set of dreams and practice false awakenings, right? That's not so easy, right? Not easy to cultivate that type of experience. It happens serendipitously.
Yes.
So one of the biggest problems with dream design is having people who can actually be subjects that allow you to study this stuff. So replication, that's why this stuff is so difficult. And I mean, it's one reason I work with these people, because I so respect what they're doing. It's like, hey, if I can help you, man, I'm there. So studying this stuff, Katie, is really slippery. If you had somebody, there would be ways to do it. If you had somebody who could say, okay, tonight I'm going to have a set of lucid dreams, I'm going to wake up falsely for you 3 or 4 times. You can signal that. You could signal that. But anyway, I don't want to go too far up that tree. But yeah.
No, just something to ponder. Thank you, Andrew.
Yeah, thanks, dear. Appreciate it. Okay. Hey, there's Amanda, my wonderful British friend.
Hello.
Hi.
So I had 2 or 3 weeks of quite a lot of what your friend Bruce Tiff would refer to as disturbances and turbulence. And I did that dream and that breathing exercise. The shamanic thing. And I did it, but I did it early in the morning, and I did it very powerfully. And what happened is I really felt as if I'd blasted out through the top of my head. I mean, really, really far away.
Yeah.
And I felt a bit frightened, actually. But I could feel a lot of energy in my feet. And so that sort of helped me to stay with it. But I stayed anyway in that state. And what it helped me do was conversation I had to have later in the day. I probably was able to, you know, not get drawn into some of the probably underlying things which had been blown apart by this breathing process. So I think it, you know, going through the chakras the way we did, I suppose it cleared stuff from the subconscious. I don't know. I don't know what you make of that process.
When you say process, you're mentioning several different things. So what's the referent? When you say process, which process?
Well, when we did the breathing, shamanic breathing, we started with the lower chakras and went all the way up the system. Right. Because I have a feeling I was accessing stuff that was stuck in the subconscious that, cleared by doing this, you know.
For sure.
But I said it was quite frightening feeling so blotted out, and I had rather a headache afterwards for quite a long time, I have to say. I mean, obviously a lot of energy was moving.
So let me ask you a couple of questions, because that type of fear is completely interesting and appropriate. Outside of the energy, what else made it feel disquieting? What gave you the sense of fear or unsettledness? Where was that coming from?
Because I felt as if I was blasted too far out,
yeah.
And that how would I get back in and get on with the day? If you see what I mean?
Yeah, that totally makes sense. So yeah. First of all, it's completely appropriate. It's a loss of reference point. It's basically a mixing of minds, quite literally, almost to an extent where, again, there's... let me back out a little bit. The next time this happens, or even retrospectively, try this. The next time this happens, notice that when you're actually being launched off, or when you're actually having the experience and in this kind of first hit of the experience itself, perhaps notice the sense, the affective feeling tone that precedes the fear of complete openness, exhilaration, freedom. Notice that. Mm-hmm. And then notice, because of habitual pattern, the tail still wags the dog. Notice how there's going to be something happening at lightning speeds back here that's going to say, wait a second, where do I fit into this? Well, you don't, right? Mm. Right?
Yeah.
You and that experience are mutually exclusive. That's where the fear comes from. Because at the moment of the experience, it's liberating, it's free, it's a moment of the enlightened space. But then because it's not stable, the tail's still there wagging, all of a sudden there's this lightning fast. Something's going to come in like a thought bubble at a subconscious level that says, wait a second, what about me? Well, there is no you. But then what happens in the very instant of that thought, the very instant that accompanies this thought, this is bloody brilliant stuff, man. Do you like the British interjection, by the way, bloody? This is bloody brilliant suggestion of how it happens is the moment you feel the fear completely simultaneous with that, you're going to feel a contraction. It's the same thing. The fear brings about the sense of contraction that then brings about instantaneously the self sense that then looks back upon the experience and says, man, this is shitty scary, right? So the fear only comes from referencing.
Mm.
So therefore, when you have that in the future, you'll go, oh my God, he's right. When I'm actually in that space, this is like liberating. I'm like a dakini. I'm dancing in space. But then the devolutionary tale comes in and says, what about me? Well, there's no me there. But then the meaning you have that thought, contract, self sense of self comes back online, commentary starts, boom, you've left nirvana, you're back in samsara.
No, well, the good thing is I had heard the interview you did with Pema Chodron just a few days before. And what I heard from that was her saying, you know, that 108 times a day, she says, out there, out there. So I've been doing that. So I did retain this out space thing without being frightened. And I just realized what she said is so important is that, you know, frequently during the day is just to look up and just out there, out, you know?
Yeah, mix your mind with space. Absolutely.
Yeah. So it was okay. But anyway, it was just interesting to have cleared so much. But what I just wanted to ask you was about this thing about the dream work, because I did have trouble stabilizing my sleep patterns, and now they're stable. But the issue is that if I do wake up early and do some and go back into a lucid dream, it does mean in the day I don't feel quite as refreshed as I've felt when I've been having proper sleep. So there's a bit of a dilemma there. And the other thing is, with the Theravadan approach, I was with Ajahn Sumedho, who's an Ajahn Chah, one of that lot. I mean, we did do very intense work with fear and desire, Vipassana. And I know that hearing the webinars again about dream yoga, that, you know, number four is, you know, when you look at fear and stuff. So I've done a lot of it in the day. And therefore, I mean, is it necessary for me to think now I should really be doing more of this stuff in the night?
No. It's just an option, right? You again, don't shit on yourself. Don't shit on yourself and don't shit on others, right? Stop shitting. So yes, if you have a connection to the fear thing and you want to work with fear, then that becomes a frequency of practice that you can engage with. But if you're, especially you mentioned Bruce stuff, you know, if you work with Bruce's really, really wonderful stuff on fear and anxiety, on one level, you could say that's enough. The level of dream work just in a certain sense augments that. Maybe you could say cautiously amps that up. But yeah,
right.
Just relax around that and don't shut on yourself anymore.
Because, you know, Namkhai Norbu, you know, says that if we practice in the dream state or sleep state. So I have had some dreams where I've seen myself meditating, but I saw it more like a witnessing thing rather than I was actually meditating. Do you see what I mean? I see my figure.
I do.
But so I mean, but I feel I've got an opportunity at the moment since my sleeping is better to try and explore this more. And I just wondered if you could help me to do that. I mean,
well, outside, in addition to what I just said, I'm not entirely sure what you mean by that, Ananda.
Well, I probably should discipline myself to try and explore this dream world more while I have, you know.
I think it's worth it. But again, listen, we're going to post. Actually, it might be posted. Did we post it already, Alyssa, on iClub, the Ryan Hurd thing?
Not yet.
Right.
Not yet. Yeah, so we're going to post that ASAP, like a really rich conversation. And Ryan, I mean, this guy's really great. By the way, he's going to be subbing in when I'm teaching in your turf in Europe. He's going to be helping us out for nightclub. You'll see why. He's amazing.
Right.
And that I'm going to refer to what we talked about there. But we talk about the difference between not too tonight, not too loose, and the role of effort. That you want to work with this stuff, but the nocturnal business, a little bit like meditation business altogether, doesn't quite abide unequivocally by the same principles of effort and practice during the day. It's a little bit different territory. And by this, what I mean, and I discovered this in myself and Ryan talked about it, you know, it's like, oh man, you know, I got to have these lucid dreams. I'm going to have more dreams. I got to pound it out. And then you get all frustrated and you just collapse and you give up and then you start having them. It's like putting your finger on a bead of mercury. These practices are mercurial. They don't abide by the traditional principles, which is why so many people get frustrated. The logic is different. The physics is different. Everything is different. And so here is the idea of not too tight, not too loose, that we have to find our sweet spot. Yes, there has to be some effort or it's not a yoga. It's not a practice. But if it's too tight, it's the horse, your mind will buck. And in a certain sense, it's going to flip you off saying, I'm not going to give you a lucid dream because you're way too tight, right? And so then you have to chill out, back off, relax. Often I do that. And it's like, heck, that's when the dreams start happening, right? So that's where you have to balance. This is where it makes it more advanced practice. You have to be your meditation guide here. You have to bounce between these two extremes and find your own sweet spot. That's why this is a more advanced practice. It's nobody's there to go in there with you. Nobody can hold your hand. But understanding these parameters of not too tight, not too loose, you will find your sweet spot. I often find, and as Ryan shares in his story, he's doing his paper, he's got to write this thing. I've got to have these dreams. He doesn't have them. He's trying too hard. He relaxes. Guess what happens? They start happening. So somewhere in there, we find our sweet spot, right? And that's again what makes this stuff fun, frustrating, mercurial, the whole thing. It's why this stuff is a little bit tricky.
Right. And so the Spanish, because you know, it's quite close to me where your thing in Spain is. But that's for the traders, isn't it? It's so that they can do that.
No, you can come. You can come to that one. You can come to that one. Yeah. That's open. Yeah. It's on their website. Yeah, that's open to the public.
I mean, so that'll be covering a lot of this, won't it? Yeah.
Oh, yeah, sleep for sure. And,
yeah. Okay. Okay. Oh, sure. I think I'll do that.
Okay. See you there.
Thanks a lot. Thank you. Bye.
Okay.
Bye. Thanks.
Ciao, ciao. Hey, Hamish. One or two more and then maybe.
Hi. Hi, thanks. It's actually Hamish, but never mind.
Hamish. Oh, sorry. Yeah,
Scottish for James. So I put this in the chat earlier, but I have since my teens, I'm 70 now, I've had very vivid dreams.
Oh, cool.
But since studying this, the dreams are just as vivid, if not getting more vivid and more expansive.
Cool.
The thing is, I get dream signs, things that are humanly impossible in the waking world.
Yep.
But I don't realize that they're dream signs until I wake up and review the dream. And I go, that was a dream sign. Oh. Right. So the question then is how can I become aware of the fact that they are dream signs in order to become lucid? Because I've only become lucid very briefly a few weeks ago, flying. Yeah. And I was so awed by it that, of course, I woke up.
Yeah, first of all, it takes a little bit of time.
Mm-hmm.
And secondly, if you have a particular set of dream signs, you know, in a certain sense, I wouldn't say they're infinite. There are a lot of dream signs. But what I've discovered in my experience and with others, and maybe this is what you'll discover with yours as well, this is where dream journaling comes in. Start writing these puppies down.
I write them all down.
Right. Yeah. Okay. Write them down, circle them, highlight them, memorize them. Because okay. I'm telling you, at a certain point, they're going to kind of bottom out. In other words, you're going to start flipping through the Rolodex, right? Okay. And you'll start to notice, oh, there's that dream sign. Oh, there's that one. And then all of a sudden, this is where recurrent dreams come in, or recurrent dream signs. Right. So it's increased familiarity that comes into play. That definitely
okay.
helps. Okay. Secondly, is work with this more and more during the day. Just, you know, do state checks like all the okay. time. I do these yeah. with so much regularity. Exactly. Mm-hmm. I'm so conditioned to this. Like if I were sitting here and one of my books fell off the shelf, I'm telling you right now, I would just jump up because I do these things all the time. And so I would right. just say become more. And by the way, these things also double as death signs. The more you do this, the more familiar you get with them, the more that habit pattern will translate into the nocturnal experience, and then the more these will start to click in. I think if you play with both of those, and against the word play, not work, if you yeah. work, it's too tight, play with them, then yeah. eventually you'll start to notice patterns. You write down those patterns, you have this little kind of discography or uh-huh. glossary of your own dream signs, and then they'll start to really work for you. Recurrent dreams are super helpful here. That's where you can use recurrent dreaming as a way to work with lucidity through iteration of dream signs. So I think if you do those two things and get back to me in a month, you'll notice the difference.
Wonderful. That brings me to my next very brief question. Okay. Recurring dreams. My root teacher, Namjo Rinpoche, who was from Canada, he passed away a number of years ago. Since then, I have had recurring dreams of being with him.
Cool.
So as the previous person asked, was that my imagination or was he actually there? Like the Rinpoche turning around and said, that was me.
That's impossible to answer.
Okay.
I would say probably yes. And here's one way to suss that out. And this is just me. What's the affective feeling tone? When you wake up, my experience is when I feel these, you know, I've had a number of these. I've been so blessed, so lucky. When I have these experiences, I wake up in the morning and I'm just glowing. I mean, I just realized somehow my sleep has been blessed. Whatever entered my mind, I mean, I maybe should give myself a little bit more credit, you know, but my unconscious mind is not as pure, right? Let's just be very candid, right? And so I wake up from that morning, I'm glowing. I just want to hug the universe. That agency was in my mind space.
I feel the same way. Yes,
exactly. And then so much. Trust that.
Yeah.
I've had others.
It's more of a feeling of deep gratitude. And exactly. I feel that it's been a real visitation.
It's a blessing. It's a blessing yeah. visitation. Trust that. Yeah. I've also had other dreams, you know, almost like parenthetical, like cameo appearances, right? I'm having a dream and there's a little cameo appearance of Trungpa Rinpoche or something. I wake up from that, then it's like, I think that was just me. I think that was just my neurological riff. So that's just the way I centrifuge out these two. Can I say with total authority? No, but that's the way I relate to it. And I think you're moving on this. You just know there's something, you know, first thought, wake up in the morning when the light is still striking before the thunderclap or the commentary comes in, that's where you'll find the truth. But yeah. usually what happens is we start to look back. The spin doctors start to go to work. Usually the doubt comes in. Don't listen to that crap. Hit the mute button. Pay attention to that first somatic affective feeling tone when you first wake up. Trust that because it's
okay.
body.
Okay, super. Thank you so much. All right.
Very welcome. Okay. Let me just spin through some of these quickly. I don't mean to be rushing, but I've been listening to Rupert Spira. I love him. In fact, he's been on the docket for months. He's agreed to do a podcast with me. I'm the one that just needs to get back to him. I adore this guy's work. I've been listening to Rupert Spira, curious what you know, think of him. I've read tons of his stuff. I mean, the guy is a colossal online YouTube presence. I like him a lot. His meditation method is different from shamatha. Yes, he's not a shamatha kind of guy. He's an Advaita Vedanta guy. And so his whole approach is, again, not a criticism, but this is one of the things I do want to talk to him about, slightly absolutistic. But I love him. I think his work is great. His book, The Nature of Consciousness, Essays on the Unity of Mind and Matter. This freaking book is brilliant. I'm a big fan of Rupert's. He and Bernard are really good friends, and I can see why. They're awesome together. Big fan of Rupert's. Okay. Thank you. Great. One. Andrew, since joining nightclub, I've had many dreams where I dream about dreaming. Dreams where you dream about dreaming. That's cool. Good for you. Just had 3 or 4 this week. Awesome. I'm often in a class or discussion group focused on dreams. I guess that's in a dream, right? They're mostly not lucid. That's okay. But they do seem very clear, and the information presented seems very real as this, rational and logical and sometimes new. Do you think there could be a classroom occurring in the inner planes? Hell yeah. But I wouldn't freeze the classroom. Don't think that there is some pre-existing classroom. You're like room 404, right? Right? Room 404 is waiting for me in hallway 3 in the education building. I'm going to go there tonight. Now, I'm playing with you, but you get the idea. Is there a classroom going on? For sure. Classrooms take place anywhere. Just don't reify it, Tim. Just don't reify it. But this is beautiful. Is there some classroom occurring on the inner planes? Absolutely. This is kind of part of the night, night school curriculum for sure. Okay, follow up for question from Tanya. If I focus my mental awareness to an area inside my head, okay, approximately area of my left brain hemisphere, okay, would fMRI pick up increased blood flow in the brain tissue accordingly? Probably, yes. Yes, I can't say with authority, but yes, probably. That's what fMRIs do. If yes, would that not finally prove primacy of the mind? Well, it won't prove it, but it will suggest it. Proving, here's the thing about proof. In the scientific community, you don't really prove anything. If you don't have a falsifiability thing, it's more about, any authentic scientists will be extraordinarily hesitant to ever use the word proof. It's highly suggestive, it's indicative, it's pointing towards. So the proof thing is highly suggestive. I wouldn't say prove. That's a little bit too closed door to me. And any scientist would say, yikes, that's a proof is a 4-letter word. And scientists can't count very well, but it's actually 5 letters, but you get the idea, right? I love my science brothers and sisters. They're the greatest. But just like everybody else, strengths and weaknesses. Okay, Stargate program. Oh, yeah. Steve McMoneagle was great at remote viewing, has been tested successfully. Yeah, great. But is remote viewing the same as shared lucid dreaming, Tim? Is it? I don't think so. Okay, getting done here. Perhaps legitimate OBEs are difficult to test scientifically. Yes, they are, like sleep yoga. Yes, but scientists are working with sleep yoga, because I know, because I'm working with them. Charlie Morley used to be a non-believer. Now he believes they are real. Yes, because he married a woman who works with OBEs. His wife this is her big thing, right? Or his ex-wife, I should say. Robert Wagner calls him reality plus one. Oh, that's a nice languaging. I like that. I just was in contact with him, by the way. Alan Wallace says the Dalai Lama gave an advanced teaching on this. Yes, it's in the book, Sleeping, Dreaming, Dying. I know that book and I know that teaching. But Alan lets the reader decide for themselves, yes, if they are real or not. I think Claire Johnson believes they are real. Depends on what you mean by real. So this is where you have to listen to the podcast with Sean Esbjorn Hargens on his ontology matrix. Real, what kind of real? Yes, it's real. It depends on what kind of real. On the 3 different stations of the ontology matrix, it's real. So absolutely, it just depends on the granularity of what you append the label real to. It's real. Does it mean it's physicalistic real? Maybe not. Is it phenomenologically and epistemologically real? 100%. So it depends on what kind of real you're talking about. I'm not being clever here. This type of granularity is actually very important when you start talking about this stuff. Listen to that talk and read that paper, Wild Cosmos, in the Sean Esbjorn Hargens interview. His ontology matrix is brilliant. Yes, Robert Wagner. Yes, I know. He has a book devoted to shared dreaming. I'm agnostic on this. I think it's completely possible. I have not had this experience, but that doesn't mean anything. Okay. Yes, an immense world. Yes, thank you, Tanya. How animal senses reveal the hidden realms around us. It gets a little bogged down. There's like TMI. There's so much information. But it's a beautiful book. And it definitely has changed the way I relate to my dog, birds. It's just a wonderful way to talk about everything we talk about today. It's a beautiful, beautiful book. Okay. What is a good book about the five Buddha families, the Jnana Buddhas? Journey Without Goal, Trungpa Rinpoche, The Five Wisdom Energies by Irini Rockwell. She talks about it in that respect. The Five Buddhas, Luminous Emptiness, Understanding the Tibetan Book of the Dead, because the five meditation Buddhas are the ones that appear in the first 5 days of the Bardo. I'm confused about how skandhas relate to meditation Buddhas, or just confused in general. Oh, Pramna Shariputra, I love you. You're so great. Yes, I'm with you. I'm just as confused as you are. I'm confused about how skandhas relate to meditation Buddhas. Oh, boy. This is such a big question. This is a big one. Basically, the skandhas, when they're purified, right, become the five Buddhas. So what you want to understand here, I'm trying to think of other books. Another book by Trungpa Rinpoche, I think it's literally just called Mandala. Orderly Chaos, my mistake. Orderly Chaos. Anything that that deals with Mandala principle deals with this. Tantric versions of the skandhas you won't find this in classic Theravadan renderings. They don't talk about this at all. But Trungpa Rinpoche was one of the main folks that riffed on this a lot. So Orderly Chaos, Journey Without Goal, those two books, there's some really great stuff. And then his student, Irina Rockwell, a good friend of mine, her book, I think it's called The Five Wisdom Energies. She talks about this. Okay, I missed the last few meditation evenings. When did Andrew lead the shamanic meditation? I have not. I only do this one in person. This cannot be given online. Next time I'll be doing it will be in Menla in September with Bob Thurman. I don't teach that online. It's too intense. It's too powerful. Rupert Spire will be a garrison. Yes, he was there last year as well. He's great. I really like Rupert. I'm going to get him on the site. I mean, I've been in contact with Ruth. I just need to set it up. But I really like Rupert. He's great. We brought him on. I'm in this little science academic study group. We brought Rupert in there and had a really great conversation with all the scientists. Super fun. Jade Shaw, exactly. Charlie's wife, Jade. I've never met her. I've been in contact with her. She seems like a beautiful person. So I don't want to do anything but support her and Charlie. Charlie's a good friend. I haven't met Jade, but if somebody's connected to Charlie, got to be cool. Jade seems really cool. Yeah, Sai Baba in India frequently appeared to his followers in dreams. Yes, he did all the time. He used to sit on their beds and advise them what to do in their lives. Absolutely true, 100%. Sai Baba was a real siddha. He did this kind of stuff all the time. I met him once in India, really cool guy. Yes, we're done, yay! We made it, 3:30. Okay, everybody. So remember, we dedicate the merit so we don't get too narcissistic and self-absorbed in what we're doing here. What we're doing here is not a feel-good strategy. We're not here. Yes, we're here to self-improve ourselves out of existence, basically. This is not a self-improvement plan. This is a self-transcendence plan. So yes, we do this to improve. Yes, yes, yes. But we basically want to improve ourselves out of existence. What we're doing here is for the benefit of others. Please remember that. And again, if you want to accelerate your spiritual path, the only way you'll accelerate it is if you do it for other people. No kidding. If you do it just for yourself, it ain't going to work. That's why when you do tantric practices, before you do any tantric practice, if you don't have bodhicitta, if you don't have the heart mind of a compassionate awakening, tantra doesn't work, man. And so always remember that what we're doing here, we're doing it for the world, for this planet, for all these animals written about in this beautiful book, for the planet itself, for the people in Ukraine. Always, always remember that. This is not about you, because there isn't one. So dedication and merit, bring it all together and then shine it out to all the animals. And if you want to unmute yourself and turn your camera on, we can do this little group hug fest, which is kind of fun. Otherwise, I'll see you around the block. You know how I roll. All the best to you and great, great fun to hang out with everybody. Bye.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye. Bye. Thank you.
Great.
Wonderful. Wonderful. Wonderful.